picture a dry lake bed in the California desert. It's the kind of place where the sun doesn't just warm you, it presses down on you. Out at China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station, there's a ramp full of old airframes. Some are targets, some are test articles, and somewhere out there, sitting in the heat and the dust and the wind, is a Boeing B-29 Superfortress. It's not flying. It hasn't flown in decades. It's been sitting there since the 1950s, being used to train firefighters. Every few months, they spray it with fuel and light it up. Practice the suppression, put the fire out, then let the airplane sit and bake in the desert sun until it's time to do it again. Nobody standing on that ramp is thinking about Wichita. Nobody is thinking about the firebombing of Tokyo. Nobody is thinking about the most complicated piece of machinery the United States had ever put into the sky. They're thinking about fire suppression technique. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now let's talk about the B-29. If you want to understand what it took to bring that airplane back, you first have to understand what a B-29 actually is, because this is not a simple airplane. This is not something you pull out of a barn and bolt a few parts back on. The Superfortress was the most technologically advanced aircraft in the world when it flew, and in a lot of ways, it was too advanced. It was reaching for something aviation wasn't quite ready for. Boeing started designing the Superfortress in the late 1930s, back when the strategic bomber was the weapon everybody believed would win the next war. The requirement was simple to state and nearly impossible to meet. Build something that can carry 10 tons of bombs 3,000 miles and bring the crew back home. The airplane that came out of that requirement was revolutionary on almost every front. The B-29 had a pressurized fuselage, which sounds routine now, but in the early 1940s it was engineering on the absolute edge of what was possible. The crew could fly at altitude without oxygen masks, without heated flying suits. That was unheard of for a heavy bomber. It had remote-controlled gun turrets, operated by gunners who sat at sighting stations and aimed them electronically. The central fire control computer could coordinate multiple turrets tracking a single target. In 1943, this was the kind of technology that made engineers lose sleep. And then there were the engines. The Wright R-3350 duplex cyclone, 18 cylinders, 2,200 horsepower each, four of them. Big, powerful, and famously temperamental. The engine cooling on the B-29 was always a problem. The nacelles were tight, the cowling design was imperfect, and those engines had a habit of overheating on the long climbs to altitude. More than a few crews were lost to engine fires before they ever got within range of a Japanese target. The B-29 program cost more to develop than the Manhattan Project rivaled. Think about that. More than the atomic bomb itself. And yet they pushed it into service because the war didn't wait for perfect. The Superfortress first saw combat in 1944. Flying out of bases in India and China, bombing Japanese targets in an operation called Matterhorn. The logistics were brutal. Every gallon of fuel, every spare part had to be flown over the hump, over the Himalayas, from India into China. It took roughly 7 gallons of fuel to deliver 1 gallon to a forward base. The math didn't work, the campaign didn't work. General Curtis LeMay eventually moved the B-29 campaign to the Mariana Islands, Tinian, Guam, Saipan. From there, the distances worked. From there, the Superfortress could reach Japan and come home. LeMay changed the tactics. He stripped the guns out of most of the airplanes, pulled the armor, loaded them with incendiary bombs, and sent them in at night at low altitude. The brass thought he was out of his mind. You don't fly a bomber low and slow over a defended target. That's how you lose airplanes and crews. But LeMay understood something the Japanese hadn't accounted for. Their night fighter and anti-aircraft defenses were calibrated for high-altitude attack. They weren't ready for what was coming. On the night of March 9th into the 10th, 1945, more than 300 B-29s flew over Tokyo and dropped incendiary bombs. What followed was catastrophic. 16 square miles of the city burned. By some measures, it was the deadliest air raid in history, including Hiroshima. The B-29 did that 5 months later. Two very specific superfortresses, Enola Gay and Boxcar, carried atomic bombs to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The war ended. The Superfortress had done what it was built to do. After the war, many of the surviving B-29s were flown to storage or disposal. Some were scrapped. A group of them, at China Lake out in California, were turned over to the base for training. The Navy had good reasons for wanting real big airframe out there, fire suppression training, crash rescue drills, having an actual heavy bomber to practice on, to drag hoses around, to spray foam over, was genuinely useful, so the airplane sat. They burned. They were put out. They sat some more. One of those airplanes had been named Doc. The names came from the Disney film, Snow White's Seven Dwarfs. The B-29s out at China Lake all had names. Doc. Sleepy. Bashful. Happy. They were just training props by then, but somebody had given them names once, back when they were still airplanes and not fixtures in a firefighting exercise. In 1987, a man named Tony Mazzolini was out at China Lake on business, and he walked past that ramp and he saw Doc sitting there, weathered, scorched in places, but structurally, remarkably intact. The bones of the airplane were still there. Now here's where it gets interesting. Tony Mazzolini was not an aviation historian. He wasn't a warbird collector with a restoration shop and a deep budget. He was a businessman with connections to Wichita, Kansas. And the thing about Wichita is Wichita built the B-29. Boeing's Wichita plant was one of the primary production facilities for the Superfortress during the war. More B-29s came out of Wichita than anywhere else. Thousands of people in that city built those airplanes. Their parents built those airplanes. When Tony Mazzolini looked at that burned and weathered bomber sitting in the California desert, something in him said, "That doesn't belong here." He started asking questions. Who does this airplane belong to? Can it be moved? What would it take to get it released? The Navy's answer was not enthusiastic. It took the better part of a decade, years of phone calls and letters and meetings and bureaucratic patience that most of us frankly don't possess. But in 1998, the Navy transferred the airplane to a nonprofit organization called Doc's Friends. Then the real work started. The airplane was moved to Wichita, specifically to a hangar at what is now Eisenhower National Airport, which meant Doc was going home. The city that built more B-29s than anywhere else, the city where those airplanes first took shape on assembly lines, was getting one back. That detail mattered deeply to the people who showed up to work on her. And when I say people showed up, I mean volunteers, hundreds of them. Some had never picked up a rivet gun before. Some were retired aerospace workers who looked at the airframe and immediately knew what needed to be done and how hard it was going to be. Some were young people who just showed up on a Saturday morning because they wanted to be part of something that mattered. The restoration took 16 years, 300,000 volunteer hours. Let that sit for a moment. If you worked 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, without a single day off, 300,000 hours is over 100 years of one person's time. That's what they poured into that airplane. Finding parts for a type that hasn't been manufactured in decades is its own kind of adventure. Some parts came from museums, some came from private collections. Some had to be machined new from original drawings because there simply was no other option. You don't go online and order B-29 hydraulic fittings. The four Wright R-3350 engines each had to be found and overhauled. These are massive, complex power plants. The population of mechanics alive who have experience rebuilding a Wright R-3350 for flight is not large. The team had to find that knowledge wherever it existed, pass it on, and sometimes work out solutions that even the original engineers hadn't anticipated. Then the wiring, the plumbing, the instrumentation, the hydraulics, the pressurization system, every single system on that airplane, disassembled, inspected, repaired, or replaced, and put back together correctly. Through all of it ran the question that drives every serious restoration project: is this thing going to fly? Or are we building a very expensive static display? The answer came on July 17, 2016. Doc lifted off from Wichita. First flight, 1956, was the last time those wheels had left the ground. 60 years in storage and on that training ramp. When she flew again, people who had worked that restoration for over a decade were standing on the ramp. Some of them were crying. I wouldn't have blamed them if they weren't, and I respect them completely for the fact that they were. I've heard people say that warbird restoration is nostalgia, a hobby for people with more time and money than sense. I think that's exactly wrong. When Doc flew in 2016, some of the women and men who had built B-29s in Wichita during the war were still alive. A few of them came out to watch her fly. What that moment meant to them, I can't fully describe. But think about it. You build something in your 20s, something enormous, something that the whole world depended on. And then 80 years go by and somebody brings it back, and you get to see it in the air one more time. That is not nostalgia. That is a bridge across time that very few things in life can build. The other thing that flying warbirds do is teach in a way that static displays simply cannot. A beautiful restored airplane behind a rope in a museum is impressive. You understand that it existed. You can read the placard and know the specs.
But when Doc taxis out at an air show and those four big radials are turning and the prop wash is pushing people back on their heels, and you feel the sound of 2,200 horsepower times four in your chest, something changes. You don't just understand that this airplane existed, you get closer to what it felt like. The crews who flew B-29s in combat were mostly young men, 21, 22, 23 years old, 12 men in a pressurized tube at altitude over a country where people were actively trying to kill them, for 15 and 16 hours at a time, the noise of those four engines running for hour after hour, the cold seeping in at altitude despite the pressurization, the tension when the coast came up and the flak started and the fighters found them, the exhaustion on the way home. Doc doesn't hand all of that to you, but she gets you meaningfully closer. As of now, there are two airworthy B-29s left in the world. Doc is one. The other is FIFI, operated by the Commemorative Air Force, which has been flying for decades and is her own remarkable story for another day. Two, out of nearly 4,000 B-29s that were built. Every air show season, Doc flies. If you've never had the chance to see a B-29 in the air, put it on the list. If she's coming to a field anywhere near you, you go. You don't think about it, and you don't wait for a better time. Stand under that wing and look up. The wingspan is 141 feet. The top of the fuselage is taller than a two-story building. And if you're standing there early enough in the morning before the crowds come in, before the air show starts, with those four big engines cold and quiet, you can almost hear what it sounded like on an assembly line in Wichita in 1944. Then they'll fire those engines up, and you won't have to imagine. Any more information for this segment came from the Doc's Friends organization in Wichita, Kansas, and from historical records on the B-29 Superfortress program. More at RadioHanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Pull up a chair again next time.